from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. New Yorker editor David Remnick joins us in studio in the next hour to discuss his ambitious and well-researched biography of President Obama called The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. We'll speak with David Remnick about the massive amount of information he's accumulated about our 44th president and his life, and we'll hear as well what has been taking place at the Fame magazine he has headed up for the past 12 years. Forum is next with your calls, emails, and online comments. Coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. New Yorker writer and editor David Remnick joins us in studio for this hour to discuss his much-praised book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, which debuts this Sunday, his publicist Pam Henstall informed us, as number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. A Washington Post reporter for a decade, including 4 years spent in Russia, David Remnick has been at the helm of The New Yorker for the past 12 years after succeeding Tina Brown. He's also the author of a biography of Muhammad Ali, which we discussed with him on Forum back in 1998. And his book, Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire, received a Pulitzer Prize in 1994. And he joins us for this Forum Hour. And welcome.
Good to see you, Michael.
Good to see you. And, well, you know, I started thinking, how can I really begin a conversation about this book? And I think you have to begin with just the improbable nature of this extraordinary story of Barack Obama. A lot of it, talent, through a Democratic convention speech, being at the right place at the right time, luck and so forth, but an amazing and almost inimitable story in American history.
Isn't it? I mean, it's really hard to remember now because we're now focused on affairs, great affairs of state, as we should, because they affect all our lives. But it is worth remembering that this guy became president about a minute and a half after leaving the state Senate in Illinois. And most of your listeners, and including me, I cannot name probably their state senator, or very few can. And in the state of Illinois, you'd rather be an alderman in Chicago than be a state senator. And the minute he was elected U.S. Senate, after both of his main competitors falling away in various kind of divorce scandals, the talk of him running for president began immediately. So it is a really improbable and irresistible rise of an American politician.
Well, you learn an immense amount about Obama. In fact, I see this book, I know you see yourself as a reporter and a journalist as well as an editor, but I see this book as a very scholarly book because it goes into detail of all the range of shape-shifting, as you call it, of Barack Obama's personal history and the cultural effects and the political, well, revelations that go on about everything from Chicago to Indonesia and to his mother's dissertation really covers an extraordinary range. And
well, she certainly was a very serious scholar. And the funny thing about Obama's own book is that he spends, I think he makes a more rounded character of his father, who was an absence, than he does of his mother, who was a presence in his life, a very deep presence. And the more I looked into Obama's mother, the more interesting she became, the more serious she became, the finer mind she became. She wasn't just this kind of post-60s idealistic, slightly ditzy, hippie, you know, in a batik skirt. She was a very serious person who pursued a PhD dissertation in Javanese craftsmen and in the field of anthropology. And she was before her time on many issues. She was involved in things like empowerment of third world women, microloans. She got her PhD finally finished, which was a huge work. It's over 1,000 pages long. When she was 50, and 2 years later, she died.
It's amazing in some ways, as you deconstruct his autobiography, to realize how important his father was to him when he spent, what, all of 12 days with him in Hawaii? Or
10 days.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
But he was important in the way an absence can haunt a young man or a young girl's life. His mother was 17 when she got pregnant with Obama, 17 years old, with an African guy in Honolulu. And they got married. They flew off to Maui and got married in secret, came back, started living as man and wife. And when it came time for Obama Sr. to graduate from the University of Honolulu, he was a visiting Kenyan student, He left the family behind and pursued his graduate studies in Harvard, basically never to be seen again, except for many years later, for 10 days. So it was a very confusing experience for the young Obama.
So what Derrida calls the presence of absence. I mean, it haunted him his whole life, really. And certainly it gets us into the racial question, which, of course, you take up, thus the title of The Bridge, going back to Selma. And I was curious to get your response to something that just occurred recently. Obama filled out a census form and put down that he was African-American. And here he's called himself a mutt, and he's played up for many years being both black and white, and
I think we know enough about African-American history to know that that there is white blood, white genetic material in the majority of African-Americans, partly for pernicious, horrendous reasons because of the rape of so many slave women back when.
But he could have identified himself as a mixed race on the census.
Well, it just goes to prove that identity is both given to us and that we have something to say about it.
Well, in fact, you write about Selma and you talk about the campaign, Hillary Clinton channeling Blanche DuBois and talking in that southern accent. And yet you hear Obama speak and you know this is a kid who grew up in Indonesia and he's talking like a black street person in some instances.
Well, not quite like a street person, but a black churchman. I think that if you listen to him in some speeches with the drop G's and the biblical references and suddenly he's got a slightly southern tang to his speech, even though he's from Honolulu by way of Chicago and Harvard, it goes to show that he has the talent that so many American orators have, which is this ability to tilt the references, tilt the intonations to the audience a bit. You can be sure that when Obama speaks about arms control to a collection of world leaders, he's not speaking quite the same way he is in a black church in campaign mode. That's not to say that he's a phony. He's just good at it. Martin Luther King was capable of going into one venue and talking about Barth and Niebuhr and Tillich, and then going into another venue and his range of references changes to something else.
He's also thinking about Ralph Ellison, who used to talk to a black audience in a totally different way than he would talk to a white audience. And I thought of Reinhardt, the character in Invisible Man. Now, you point out to what extent Obama absorbed so much of black literature and became really in his identity identified with that.
Well, here we have a president of the United States who was perfectly comfortable talking to me in the Oval Office about Malcolm X and why he was important to him without self-consciousness. And the answer he gave me was, look, I never had any truck with Malcolm X's early belief in separatism or some of the more fantastical aspects of the Nation of Islam. That's not what interested me. What interested me was the assertion of black manhood in the autobiography at a time when so many African Americans were forced to kowtow to their white employers or people they ran across. I mean, this assertion of selfhood and pride was extremely important to him as a teenager.
You're talking a little bit before I went on air of Skip Gates, and he and others, I think about the poet Michael Harper, who said Malcolm was our manhood. And I think that's sort of what you translated from Obama, wasn't it?
I think that's exactly the way he saw Malcolm X. He, growing up in Honolulu with white grandparents, white classmates, white mother, African Americans in Honolulu are basically living on military bases. He had to go out and seek, just to a great degree, African-American-ness. He didn't walk out the door and find it. He didn't find it at the kitchen table. He had to go read books. He had to watch television. He had to listen to the music. He had to go find it. And he finally had to get off of Honolulu to get in the middle of it, first in L.A. At Occidental College, then more immediately in Columbia. And then finally, where does he really find home and a purpose and, say nothing of a wife and a pastor and all the rest, is in the south side of Chicago.
Pastor was a surrogate father to him. And in fact, in some ways, when you look at Reverend Wright, you see a man who really saw Obama in many ways as a politician and said what was true about Obama. He was a politician. He is a politician.
I think that's no more uncontroversial than calling Derek Jeter a shortstop.
But it was said in a context by Reverend Wright as to suggest that maybe he was going to bend in certain ways and he was going to be mercurial, I think. At least that was the context I took at the time. And of course,
I don't think Jeremiah Wright meant it in the kindest sense possible.
Exactly.
There's no question of that. But remember this about Jeremiah Wright for all his faults. This is a guy who did a lot of good, who built a huge church, who was socially progressive in the best sense. That's what attracted Obama as a young man. Jeremiah Wright is a very human story. One could make a great novel of it. Here's a preacher who had built a huge church, who had a big following, and who was about to retire in a blaze of triumph. And the triumph was going to be, not only had he achieved this with his church, but he had also had a parishioner who was on the edge of being the president of the United States. Instead, what happened was that he became the demon of so many. He became an object of derision, and he was responsible in large measure for his own fall because he could not contain himself. And at the National Press Club in Washington, after giving a perfectly reasonable speech, once he started answering questions, he lost it. And so Obama had to, forgive the cliche of the moment, throw him under the bus. And it was a terrible, deep wound. And as a result of the wound and Wright's own pride and ego, he refused to withdraw from the scene, and he kept it up and up and kept saying things about Obama that were potentially very damaging.
I don't want to necessarily get into that whole bag of worms again with Reverend Wright, but there was a kind of working assumption that Obama went to that church and heard a lot of that rhetoric and some talk about, you know, white people being responsible for AIDS and things that was just, that are just, one of my African-American friends said, part of the rhetoric that goes with often the preaching and sermonizing in many black churches.
For some, yeah.
How much did he buy? Really,
here's what Reverend Wright would say about this, and here's what many African-Americans would say, even without having to endorse this really preposterous theory about AIDS, is that we do live in a certain country with a certain history. And this is a country in which there was the Tuskegee experiments, in which African-Americans were deliberately given syphilis for bogus scientific reasons. So some of these conspiracy theories have a basis in historical motivation. It's not to suggest for one second that the conspiracy theories themselves are at all true. I also think that Reverend Wright puts forward theories that sound to me like pseudoscience, that somehow whites learn through one way and blacks learn through another, and their brains are different. And it really is disturbing. But I would say this, two things. One, Barack Obama is not alone in this world of having been in the pews with a clergyman with whom he had reason to like, but also reason to disagree. I mean, I have relatives who have been in synagogues with the rabbis are way, way, way to the right of them when it comes to politics. But they find virtues in them spiritually. So they don't bolt. They don't leave. Now, you may accept that, you may not, but that's the fact of the situation.
Because you point out at one point that Obama could have joined another church. He could have gone to a bigger Pentecostal church on the south side.
But then if he had gone to the Pentecostal church, he would have found a brand of Christianity that was much too alienating and atavistic for him. He would not have sat still for that style of religion, and also a distinctly more conservative view of social issues and social justice issues. So he did gravitate to that church for better and for worse.
Talking to David Remnick, his new book is The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. Let's talk a little bit about Chicago, because there's an episode in your book. Actually, Obama, even when he was in Chicago, was saying reparations seemed to be almost an advocate of the idea, but then he said it's not going to work. So he's always had that pragmatic side, as well as what he would sympathize with, perhaps, which was very, I thought, revelatory. But I also thought it was revelatory to read about an incident that happened when he was a state legislator, and he threatened to kick some guy's butt. I mean, don't associate Obama as being necessarily the tough guy.
The butt in question was a guy named Ricky Hendon. Ricky Hendon was a state senator from the West Side, more of a street guy than Obama, which is pretty easy to be. And Ricky Hendon didn't like this guy. Ricky Hendon saw this guy as a creation of Harvard and Hyde Park and the University of Chicago and et cetera, et cetera. And Ricky Hendon really razzed him from the day he arrived. And he wasn't the only one. Other members of the Black Caucus were very tough on Barack Obama. And they got in to make a very long and, I hope, hilarious story short. It's played out in greater length, obviously, in the book, in The Bridge. But they got into a dispute, and to the point where there was a kind of scuffle in the antechamber off the Senate floor. And it got to the point where there were threats, and I'm going to kick your ass, you're going to kick mine, blah, blah, blah. And Ricky Hendon tells the story one way in his own memoir, and Obama really doesn't love to talk about it at all.
What do you suppose all of this attempt is? I mean, as you see things, to associate Obama with Bill Ayers, to associate Obama, I mean, again, getting back to Chicago, he did have the first fundraiser here in Bernardine Dorn, but also to suggest, in fact, straight off the news, it's hot and exclusive, a soldier over in Afghanistan, a leading I think a major, in fact, said, "I'm not going because Commander-in-Chief wasn't born in the United States and I don't have to follow the rules of this military commander because he's not according to the Constitution." All the birthers, all of this stuff.
Yeah,
how much of it is race, do you think?
Well, I think we should separate things out here. Barack Obama saying that Bill Ayers was just somebody in the neighborhood is disingenuous. Barack Obama did know Bill Ayers. He knew him fairly well, but he knew a lot of people fairly well. And just because he knew one guy that's way to the left of him doesn't mean that he inhales his politics any more than he inhales the politics of some of his colleagues at the University of Chicago who are right-wing. Barack Obama's politics are center-left. Live with it. He was born in Honolulu on a particular day, at a particular time, in a particular hospital. There's a birth certificate. There are announcements in the local press. Live with it. But this has been part of a campaign in circles that we know, whether on Fox or on parts of the internet or what have you, that have traction with people. And does it have any relation to race? How could it not? This is the first African-American president, and to think that this would be absorbed into the political bloodstream of the United States without any incident, without any rough spots, without any people at the fringes getting a little crazy, would have been naive. And these are the manifestations of it.
Obama did exaggerate his grandfather's houseboy status to some extent, did he not?
You know, up to a point, Lord Copper, I'd say. I mean, he emphasized, in the way that all politicians emphasize the modesty of their origins.
Log cabins. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this has been going on since the days of Andrew Jackson in campaign authorized campaign biographies, not to make any excuses. What you're referring to is that Obama's grandfather, who was a man of the village, but he was not dirt poor. In other words, relative to the village life of Northwest Kenya, he was what you and I would call middle class, although in no way middle class in the sense that you and I understand it in downtown San Francisco. He also, Obama, tried to draw a line between the Kennedy family's funding of the airlift of African students in 1959, and it wasn't quite true because Obama's father had come to Honolulu a year before the Kennedys put any money into it. Are these, you know, felonies or misdemeanors of rhetoric? I would probably side with the misdemeanor.
You clearly like Obama. You were charged and elated by his success as a politician, his election to the presidency. The New Yorker, in fact, I guess, came out with an endorsement for Obama, did it not?
Well, faced with the choice between Barack Obama and John McCain, it was not, I would say, a brutal debate among my colleagues who we would endorse for the general election.
How do you avoid, though? I mean, it's just a journalistic question.
The question of bias.
Well, even more than bias, a little bit of halo hagiography, whatever.
I think we should be on guard against it. And I, you know, if you were to ask me what I think differences that I have with Obama, we could talk about it for the rest of the program. I was disappointed in his view with his handling of Guantanamo. I was disappointed in his decision to turn completely away from any reexamination of the past vis-a-vis torture and the war on terror. I'm disappointed in his refusal to engage in a very serious and upfront way about questions of human rights abroad. I'd like to see him engage in a more frontal discussion of what I think is one of the big global ideological challenges in the world today. Right now, China and Russia are posing the following challenge to all of us. They are essentially saying, as regimes, as nations, we can develop at a rapid rate economically, essentially enter the capitalist world and play by those rules and ignore the old rules of communist ideology and all the rest that was deemed a failure, at the same time completely ignoring anything approaching democratic norms in civil society. That we can develop rapidly even though we can brutalize the free expression, we can stamp out dissent, second, third, fourth parties. We can run roughshod over anything approaching democratic norms, and we can succeed and do it with the consent and assent of the vast majority of our populations. That's a huge challenge to the Western notion that free markets and democracy go hand in hand. And I haven't seen that engaged very much. What I've seen is a very, very, put a nice spin on it, pragmatic view of our relations with Russia and China. And it seemed to me, for example, Jimmy Carter, who was in no way my ideal president, at least was very successful in putting human rights questions forward in a serious way.
You mean the Olympics and
all of it, yeah. So that both the dissident community received the message and that the regimes themselves received the message. Take the same example to Iran. So it's not only a question of the immediate concerns of a nuclear Iran, which we seem to be not succeeding in stopping at all. We don't seem to be successful in acquiring really adequate sanctions quite yet. But I'm concerned that our signals to the pro-democracy movement there are not clear enough.
You know, at the same time that Obama is being brandished as a socialist, and Alinsky, who his name keeps coming up over and over from the right, who he pretty much repudiated, there's a sense that he's involved in a kind of real politic view. That you use the word pragmatic, but it even goes beyond that. I had Diane Ravitch on yesterday, and she was talking about how he's following the same educational free market ideas of the Bush administration. We've talked with people like Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz about the fact that until he brought in Paul Volcker, he was using the same economic advisors.
Okay, but let's be clear. I'm an admirer of Paul Krugman. I think Joe Stiglitz is a fascinating economist, and I'm no economist. But let's crank back the movie a little bit. Those guys said we should have nationalized banks, right? They turned out to be wrong. Those guys said TARP was going to be completely insufficient and bailouts were not going to, we were going to lose tremendous amounts of money. There was a lot of criticism on that score. I'm not just talking about Stiglitz and Krugman here. It turns out that's working quite well, far beyond the expectations of a lot of critics. So there, I think the some of the really harsh criticism has turned out to be not well-founded.
Criticism has been mainly bringing in people like Geithner and Bernanke and the same crew, Larry Summers, that worked under the previous administration.
That's part of the critique, yes.
Yeah, not necessarily moving forward. Does Barack Obama, in your judgment, really understand in a deep or profound way, as politicians perhaps can? You said you're not an economist, obviously neither is he, but understand in ways that can really help this country economic cycles and the like. This is a guy who said, I did a bonehead move with Tony Rentsko, for example, and I always think about that.
If we can come up with one president who got to the presidency without making a bonehead move, I would be loath to name him. I couldn't name him.
But you understand what I'm really asking?
I do.
Here. Yeah.
I do. Remember, we are not, when we elect politicians to the presidency, we don't elect somebody that has six PhDs in all the relevant subjects, whether it's in international relations or economics or what have you. Do I think Obama has the intellect needed to assimilate information and referee arguments over economics and then make a reasoned decision? Sure, I do.
Let me open the phone lines. Join us with David Remnick. You can do that now toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a comment on our website just by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to David Remnick. He is the editor of The New Yorker, and his new book is The Bridge. I was just thinking, in fact, about the fact that The New Yorker seems to be flourishing. I should tell you that when Ruth Reichel was on here last, everything was flourishing over there, and then maybe the day later she got the news about Gourmet Magazine, which I think is sort of the same family as The New Yorker. But The New Yorker continues to thrive under your leadership.
Thank
Gourmet
God.
Clothes.
Can I knock on wood?
You can knock on Formica.
I'll knock
Formica,
on Formica.
Yeah. Well, you've been running a tight ship, actually, haven't you? I mean, that's the word, at least.
Well, yes and no. In other words, a tight ship where I'm like the kind of movie producer who wants to see any money we spend up on the screen. I don't want to see it at the caterers, on the caterer's bill. If we need to make a journalistic trip, we're going to make it. If we need to make a second and a third trip, we're going to make it. If we're going to pursue investigative reporting, and sometimes that leads to dry wells, that's part of the cost of doing business. Where I don't want to see us spending money is foolishly, that's all.
You wrote this book about Obama, and a lot of people, I guess, have brought up that famous cover of the fist salute that was on The New Yorker, mm-hmm. and there was a good deal
fist
of controversy.
Yeah, there was a controversy about it. I think my motives are well known by now, which is that a year ago this summer, there were still polls. I'm afraid there are polls now that indicate the same thing, that a lot of people believe a lot of nonsense about the Obamas, that they are closet radicals, that they are not the religion they say they are, that they're soft on terrorism, that they are born God knows where, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really pernicious, and it was rife during the political campaign. And so the artist Barry Blitt did an image in which all of this stuff was put into one image to knock the hell out of it, to make fun of it, to put the lie to it. And a lot of people saw it for what it was, and some people, it made them anxious. And the most common reaction I got, Michael, was the following comment in letters, and I mean thousands of them. Of course I get it, but those people out there, I'm a little worried that they won't, and that it'll cause things to go awry.
It reminds me of when Shirley Jackson published a lottery in The New Yorker. There was a record number, you probably know this, of letters assuming that it was real, but also just not getting it, not really understanding what she was trying to do.
I think if you're going to be deliberately provocative in image or in word, you should, you know, expect some reaction. That reaction was more than I expected, and partly because the campaign, you know, deemed it in bad taste. But I'm not there to have a political campaign. Edit the magazine.
What was the reaction you got to doing a very flattering article about a local talk show host who doesn't need to be named, but who's essentially
Michael Savage,
a demagogue, and who says that Barack Obama is like Papa Doc Duvalier and some of these ridiculous kinds of things that you're alluding to?
I think describing it as purely flattering is not right. I think it tried to take Michael Savage, this is a piece by Khalifa Sana, who's, by the way, black, and nobody's conservative, and take him on the terms that Michael Savage proposes, which is as kind of political entertainment. And a lot of people disagreed with him and wrote a lot of letters. Look, if I published a magazine and we become somehow the amen corner for one school of thought or another, and everybody agrees with it all the time, that's immensely uninteresting to me. And part of being interesting is to be unpredictable. And sometimes that works, sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's less so. I can live with those results.
We try to operate under that same working assumption here. I was moved at one point in your book, fairly early on, in the chapter Ambition, and I just wanted to mention this and give you an opportunity to tell this story, because there Obama was at the Harvard Club in Boston, and everybody's white, and all the people who are serving are black.
Yeah, what happened was is that Obama had achieved something that had never happened before at Harvard. He became and was elected the first president of the Harvard Law Review, which is the scholarly journal run by students. And to be the president of that is to automatically enter the elite of American political life. You will certainly get Supreme Court clerkships, and your world is more or less your oyster. And in Obama's case, because he's the first African American, there were all kinds of articles in the press. Fine. A little while later, there's a ceremony, a black tie ceremony at the Harvard Club downtown Boston to mark this passage of one Harvard Law Review president to the next. And the vast majority of the guests in black tie were white. And the serving staff, the wait staff, was not. And Obama got up and he gave his speech, and the waiters in the back put down their trays and they watched rapt. And at the end, nobody was applauding louder than the people on the wait staff. And one of the waiters ran up the aisle just to shake Obama's hand. It was quite the scene.
Obama, as the orator, you point out, early on in his career when he was a politician, didn't exactly, particularly when he was running against Bobby Rush, didn't exactly galvanize and excite people.
No. What one's got to realize about any skill is that you're never any good at it in the beginning. You're probably 100 times better at what you do now than when you first dreamed of doing it.
Touch Formica.
Any great athlete is a lot better at 25 at the peak of his skills than in Little League or in high school were in college ball. Obama started running for office, and he didn't have the skills. He was rather professorial in his speeches, rather dull, maybe a little removed, diffident. It took thousands of hours in churches and church basements and meeting halls and auditoriums to get to where we saw him on the podium in 2004 in Boston.
Let's bring our callers in. And Judy, you're first up with David Remnick. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Phil, for taking my call. There's a echo. Okay. I hadn't been involved in politics in years and years and years since Kennedy, so shows you how old I am. And I heard Obama speak. I was going to vote for Hillary, no problem. I heard him speak, and it wasn't the speech he gave before, but it was, when he wanted to be president. And I was really, really took my breath away. He was not only, he was so smart, and he was so, even. He wasn't angry. I mean, he just wasn't angry, and yet I could feel that he would do what he had to do, you know, if it was to protect the country. I feel like he's a very, I felt safe with that kind of a person.
How do you feel now?
The same.
Interesting.
Absolutely the same. But what I feel now, though, is I feel a lot of negativity in terms that everybody has to, scratch over everything about him.
Well,
I feel that comes to racism. I mean,
let's be fair. It's possible to not agree with Barack Obama without being racist. Okay, I think that is. I hope, but I also think it's true that's limited to a fringe. That when you have a country when you've got 10% unemployment and continuing economic anxiety, whether it has to do with employment figures or burgeoning deficits, even though those deficits were exploded under the previous president, it's natural that there's going to be real political disagreement. It's natural that there's going to be furious political argument. But I think what's making you anxious is when you hear the extreme comments coming out of the Tea Party movement or in various places in the media. And that really is worth being anxious about because it can lead to very, very ugly things. And we don't even need to describe the ugliest of those things because of the horrendously tragic outcome it can lead to.
We thank you, Judy, for the call. I want to go to more of your calls in a moment, but I want to go to some emails first. Here's Dan who writes, I just started the book. I'm enjoying it very much so far. I noted, however, Mr. Remnick's use of the phrase aggressively incurious to describe President Bush. I wonder how long he thought about that one and what the considerations were. Incurious, of course, was the polite but ultimately ineffectual term everyone used in the media to avoid having to call him stupid. Aggressively incurious seems like an artful way to step over the threshold without quite crossing it. Did Remnick reject any other phrases in favor of that one? And if so, what were they?
I stand by the phrase. I think I can live with that one.
Well, here's one you may not stand by, according to one of our listeners who says, David Remnick's characterization of the Tuskegee experiments is incorrect. No African-Americans were given syphilis. African-Americans with syphilis were recruited for a study and not given treatment. Reprehensible, yes, but an entirely different moral situation.
True. Affecting I stand corrected.
Another listener writes, Obama, I've voted for him, so I can say this is pandering to the common idiocy of the Palin lovers who want their polls to be TV sitcom characters with these uneducated speaking accents. How can the media not comment on the fakeness that they hear? Using y'all is merely using an expression, but actually trying to sound Southern is downright insulting to the listener's intelligence. Bush was Connecticut raised, yet drawled. Hillary Clinton famously spoke like a Southerner when campaigning down South in the primaries. Even the normally level-headed Mark Shields drops his G's when moderating presidential debates. I think actually there's something curious here to me.
There's something really a little off about this. Yeah. George Bush spent years and years in Texas. Y'all doesn't bother me at all.
How about nuclear?
Look, Jimmy Carter is about as smart as he gets. Used I can't even say it. Nuclear all the time.
But you know, Obama says folks a lot. He uses that word repeatedly over and over again.
Fair enough. But sooner or later, we're all guilty of a slip once in a while. What I object to is the valorization of ignorance. The notion that Sarah Palin is at all serious when she discusses something like nuclear strategy is insulting to all of us. You know, when she gets up and talks about how Barack Obama is somehow selling us the United States out when it comes to defense strategy, that somehow she's making us deeply vulnerable, and that Ronald Reagan would never have dreamed of doing something. She's just a complete ignorance of history. Ronald Reagan, in fact, not only dreamed of, but acted on the dream of complete elimination of nuclear weapons entire when it came to the Reykjavik summit.
It's all the public record. And it was, by the way, brought on by Nancy Reagan whispering in his ear as they went to bed at night. You know that, don't you?
Well,
at least that's what we're told by the Reagan biographers.
Up to a point.
But he was committed. He was definitely dedicated to just what Obama has stood for in terms of making it a nuclear-free armament, nuclear world. Let's go to Tom next. Tom, join us. Hi.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. And I've enjoyed this really fascinating, brilliant discussion this morning. I agree, first of all, with what Ralph Nader said recently, that the only difference between Obama and Bush is that Obama is a much better speaker than Bush. I think he succeeded much more as a politician than he's had, using the bully pulpit as an educator, with the Tea Party in Guantanamo and the surge in Afghanistan and the nuclear, treaties. He hasn't been nearly as advanced, of course, even as Reagan, as was just mentioned. So he hasn't been using any of his teaching moments to even remove the stigma of the Antichrist, something like a quarter of all Republicans believe that he's the Antichrist. And his top priority, I think, should be as an educator to basically educate Republicans and the other.
That'd be quite a task to educate those who believe he's Antichrist and disbelieving it. But I'm taking what you're saying, Tom, here as being emblematic in some ways about what lots of those disaffected, I know like the earlier caller, progressives and voters for Obama feel, David. Right?
Well, I have to say, as somebody who admired Ralph Nader long ago and a great deal less so in recent years, beginning with the obvious election, that the analysis that somehow there's no difference between Barack Obama and George Bush is flip at best. And take healthcare, for example. You may find that the healthcare bill that passed was not as expansive as you might have wanted. And if you were for single payer, we are not there yet by any means. But this is a radical departure from the Bush administration and an enormous achievement, any way you cut it, in terms of domestic policy, in terms of progressive domestic policy.
Yeah. I can't agree with that. I think a single payer is the only way to go. I mean, it doesn't work just for us, but it's worked for all the advanced industrial.
I understand that, but to get to single payer, you really, unfortunately, we're going to have to leap across the abyss in three jumps.
Tom, I thank you, and let me go to some more of the emails here. David writes, what you and your guests are discussing is called code switching, which is a well-known sociological phenomenon that individuals who belong to minority groups have to do in order to integrate with the dominant culture. This is not something strange or foreign, but
not
something that millions of people experience and engage in every day.
Points well taken.
Another listener says, David, you have great skill in employing the great talent in the New Yorker. Would you hire Obama?
I think if Barack Obama were looking for a job, I certainly he can write, so who knows?
Here's a caller who asks about something that actually you go into great detail in your book about. This is Tony, who says, when Obama was running for U.S. Senate, he was going up against a popular former investment banker and first-time Republican politician, Jack Ryan. I read that Ryan was ahead in the polls until his campaign fell apart due to news about misbehavior alleged in his former wife's divorce papers. Ryan withdrew. Did Obama really just luck into a win for the U.S. Senate?
Well, there's more luck involved than that. When he was running for the Democratic nomination first, his main opponent was a man named Blair Hull, who had made a fortune in the financial industry and was willing to spend a lot of money, a la Mike Bloomberg or somebody, or Meg Whitman, and was spending it and at one point leading in the race. And all of a sudden, his campaign collapsed when his divorce records came open and they were a pretty ugly spectacle. Obama swept to victory. Then faced with Jack Ryan, as the caller indicates, Jack Ryan probably wasn't ahead, and I think Obama probably would have beaten Jack Ryan, but it would have been a very tough race. Ryan was a very attractive candidate, a Republican conservative, very good looking, big support downstate. In addition to making a fortune at Goldman Sachs, he also did a lot of charitable work. He taught in an inner city school. Obama would have had a tough time with him. His divorce records came open. They were an unedifying spectacle. And who did Obama end up running against? Alan Keyes. So by the time Obama reached November, he was giving away money that had been given to his campaign. He was so far in the lead, and giving it to other Democratic campaigns around the country.
As you point out, in this particular period in Obama's career, the trajectory that has led him to the Oval Office, losing to Bobby Rush was a real turning point for him and really an important experience.
It was a political education.
Yeah.
I think it forced him to reassess who he was and who he could be as a politician, and that he would not be a traditional African-American politician making his political life either in majority black congressional districts or attempting to be, say, the mayor of a big city where there's an enormous or even majority black vote. That was not going to be his future.
We go next to Penn Grove. Richard, you're on the air. Good morning.
I was heartened while I was waiting to come on, another excellent show, by the way, Michael, to hear you talk about leaping across the abyss in three jumps, and I have it. You made the point to the caller that I was to make with you, because earlier you sounded that, you know, you weren't getting, he wasn't doing everything you wanted, and he wasn't.
Why would we expect that?
Well, no, I don't. It sounded to me as if you were, and I just was going, you know, well, what do you want, you know?
No, look, on balance, I think this has been a very encouraging presidency. On balance, you know, I've been deeply heartened by things like the return to the discussion of real science instead of mysticism when it comes to science. That, you know, in the Bush administration, the discussion of science disappeared. I come from a family where people have suffered from various neurological diseases, and stem cell research is to be welcomed. And that was written right into the mainstream of American life the minute Obama was elected. And this is one of many examples of things that I think have been extremely encouraging about the presidency. Doesn't mean I have to agree with everything.
Would you give him as high a grade as he gave himself before the health care compromise? He said B+ for his
performance? I think the B+ was high. Once the health care thing happened, I wouldn't hesitate to give him a pretty high grade.
Another listener writes, hats off to you, David Remnick, for your writings, and to you, Michael, for excellent dialogue. Also, David, your recent cogent and concise clear-the-air short piece about Obama's long relationship with Jews in Israel and the New Yorker was very much needed. I voted for Obama and would again, but I'm disappointed in him tactically and ideologically. Immediately in the White House, he took on too many issues at once, then took far too many trips abroad instead of more hands-on activity to push through the health care bill and the financial reform measures, the latter being now a patch job that may not save America from another meltdown the U.S. Treasury will not have resources to ameliorate. Also, tarp-heeled banks, in Wall Street has still done nothing to lessen unemployment. Do you think he's learning on the job? I think the obvious answer.
Well, I think anybody learns on the job. But here's the problem. He came into office with a range of crises that really beggar the imagination. I mean, most presidents come into office and there may be an enormous looming crisis, maybe two hostages in Iran when Reagan came in, whatever it might be. This guy came in. The financial system is on the brink of collapse. The auto industry, an enormous industry, is on the brink of utter collapse. Decisions have to be made about Iraq. Decisions have to be made about Afghanistan, about the security of the country, about Iran. One could keep going and going. This was no joke. So to say that he tried to do too much at once, I don't know what the alternative is, except to maybe do too little, too slow, and we'd be in deep, deep trouble.
You know, David Brooks wrote an article sometime back where he said the difference between Obama and Bush, and, you know, he's the conservative all liberals love to love and all that, but he was saying essentially, here you have Bush, who made decisions very quickly, often wrong, but was much more resolute in making decisions. Here you have Obama, the intellectual who agonizes over decisions like in Afghanistan. Mm. Do you see that kind of clear-cut dichotomy between the two?
Well, up to a point, but I know what I prefer, the latter. I mean, you know, sort of incurious resolution and clear-cutness in the absence of evidence led us into a lot of very, very deep holes.
We go to more of your calls, and let's go to Kevin. Good morning.
Hi. I am struck by what is to me a great gap between Obama's rhetoric and what's actually happening on the ground. For instance, and during his inauguration speech, he said we shouldn't have to compromise our freedoms in order to get security. But once in office, he has done very little to reverse what George Bush has done. There's still surveillance. They're still trying to keep people in jail, and he's fought in court for this, trying to keep people in jail forever without charge and so on. I mean, it just and there's many, many other things. So from this point of view, and there's lots of people who agree with me, he doesn't measure up.
Well, it's always a balance. I mean, in fairness, there is no question that security needs sometimes are going to be a challenge to absolute liberty, and that this balance, it's a question of how you strike the balance. What's disappointing, and I think that we probably agree to some measure, is that he has struck the balance in a way that resembles the Bush administration on certain points more than we'd like.
As a listener says, an observation from one black man's perspective. White people, generally speaking, know very little about blacks, African Americans. Being black, I know lots about white folks. I'm surrounded by whites all the time, at school, at work, out in the public, on TV, etc. I'm amazed at some of the concerns and questions people have about President Obama. It seems unfair at times to me, but not really a surprise, and I realize it's early in his term, but from what I can see so far, so good. I hope he is really able to achieve substantial change for all of us, but finally help the people who need it the most, the poorest, the least educated, the disenfranchised. Terry writes, thank you, David Remnick, for this hour and listening to your comments about Obama's use of black vernacular. I'd like to recommend the book by Stanford linguist John Rickford and his son, Spoken Soul, The Story of Black English. Certainly, African-American vernacular is, in the words of the Rickfords, essential to the crucible of identity. James Baldwin described black English as this passion, this skill, this incredible music emerging from a troubled American history. The Rickfords point out that most African Americans invoke spoken soul as we have for hundreds of years to laugh or cry, to preach and praise, to shuck and jive, to sing, to rap, to express our individual personas and our ethnic identities. Oh, maybe that's why he put it down on the census. Another listener says...
I think he put it down on the census because that's who he is. That's how he understands himself and that's who he is. And I didn't understand the fuss. I really didn't.
But, you know, even in your book, there's an implication of his being maybe not so properly respectful toward his mother as he should be.
Look, this is also a guy whose mother was gone throughout high school. And I think there's some element of disappointment in that, confusion about that. He was a young guy who was, you know, he wasn't a mess by any stretch of the imagination. He wasn't a drug addict. He wasn't stealing. He wasn't cutting school. I mean, to some degree in the memoir, he makes it sound perhaps a slight degree darker than it actually was. But he could have used more guidance. But there was a limit on how much his mother could help him on certain questions. I mean, your white mother giving you Mahalia Jackson records or pertinent books doesn't quite do the trick. He had to find out a lot of these things on his own.
There was a good deal of cannabis use by Obama, though.
I don't think he was alone in this.
No, of course not. But it always interested me. In fact, when the cocaine came out about him, he's using cocaine and accidental. Yeah. It's in your book, too.
Yeah.
That more of a fuss wasn't made about it. It's like we crossed the Rubicon on that one, didn't we?
I think we did cross the Rubicon on that. I don't think anybody at this point in a serious way, unless they're inclined to use it as a political weapon, is naive. I mean, who among us, right? I mean...
I'd just like to see him quit smoking at this point, I think. You know.
I think he's gotten more guff about sneaking cigarettes than he has about smoking a fair amount of dope when he was in high school. Who cares?
We'll go to another caller here, and Charlie joins us. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. It's a wonderful book you got, Mr. Remnick.
Thank you.
But I'm wondering whether the Afghanistan debacle of war of attrition is going to bring the president down just like LBJ.
Well, I don't remember that LBJ, within a year of being in office, put a real time limit on Vietnam. What happened with LBJ and Vietnam? Remember one thing about history, that we always talk about the examples of history as if one thing equals another. And I swear to God, the older I get, the more I study history, the more journalism I do, and the more I keep my eyes open as a citizen, one thing does not equal the other. And we will see. And the Afghanistan policy is a curious policy that tries to almost put a camel through the eye of a needle, which is to say there's an increase in troops in order to achieve what a surge would achieve, and then there's a time limit on how long we're going to stay. Considering who our partners are in Afghanistan, I am not a bright-eyed optimist about all of this. And it seems the best outcome that could occur here is a kind of rough truce, a rough holding off of the onslaught of the Taliban, and then an eventual lowering of troops limits by the United States at a fairly decent clip. This is not going to end in a blaze of glory, and I just hope it doesn't end in its opposite.
And I thank the caller. Well, a lot of emails here that we're not going to get to here, but there is certainly criticism of Obama coming down from both sides, and the question is, can that shape-shifting, do you think, work to his best advantage in the years to come? I mean, he's certainly done well by it. He's had enormous success as a result.
Again, I want to emphasize this about shape-shifting or the differences in intonation in speeches. This is not this is not indicative of a phony. And I teased it out and write about it in the book only to describe what I see as a kind of political talent that was developed over time.
But it's a resiliency and it's a kind of mercurial quality that has served him well.
And well, that's another matter. His resiliency, his character, which some people find diffident and cool and a little bit impenetrable, has also served him well in terms of endurance. David Axelrod said something very interesting to me. He said, you know, when I walk in that room, and he was pointing to the Oval Office, I always know what I'm going to get. That there's not a lot of stormy weather in there. People that used to work for Clinton knew to expect a certain amount of early morning rages, whether it was reacting to the press or other things. And Clinton's moods were mercurial. Obama is a very different kind of cat.
He's Spock, so they say. David Remick, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. David Remick's book, again, is The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg, Erica Kelly. Our interns, Jeremy Blackman, David Carini, Julia Jackson, Alexander Park, and Mithya Srinivasan. And our engineer is Danny Bringer, our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being here for all of us at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.